This is an RSA podcast. RDI Insights. Mike Dempsey in conversation with Royal Designers.
The graphic designer Piers Marchbank is synonymous with editorial design. His work is never just decorative, but always delivers a solid idea executed with simple directness. This is most evident in his classic work for the London listings magazine Time Out. From 1970 to 1983, he designed its covers, and over two decades on, they still represent a benchmark in editorial design that hasn't been surpassed. That same graphic simplicity can be found in his more recent work for the John Lewis Partnership, where he has designed packaging for their kitchen utensils, ceramics, and glassware. He runs his own consultancy, Studio 20, based in London's Bloomsbury, where I spoke to him about his long career. You went to Central in 1966, and unlike many students at that time, you were busily working away towards the end of your period there by whizzing around the corner and art directing architectural.
Yeah, I was actually on a salaried job, I think, for the last few months of being at Central.
Yeah, which is quite extraordinary, really.
Central wanted half my salary, which I never replied to the letter.
Let's go on to Oz magazine, which you designed a few issues. I don't think it was that many during the
three or four,
the old Bailey Obscene Publications Act trial, which meant that all of the editors were away.
And you
were left to produce the. Were you producing the magazine itself in its complete form?
Yeah.
How was that? Because that was such a... I mean, you probably know that they're making a film at the moment, or they will be very shortly.
Yeah, I haven't been in touch with me, though. But
a film is being made about the trial and the whole kind of...
They would have been highly illegal if they had anything to do with publishing another issue of Oz when they were in prison or on trial. I was approached by people associated with them. I knew them all well anyway, when they were in prison with two other people, Jonathan Green and David Widgery, to be joint editors, and I was to design it and produce an issue which came out while just after their appeal had gone through. We then did a second issue, and later I did another issue and half of another one after that. I was working at Time Out at the time, and I had to work at Time Out the day and then did Oz all night. And thank God I was only about 23 years old, because I couldn't do it now.
No. Well, I'm going to, just before we go on to Time Out, which, you know, is probably the, even though you've done lots of things since, Time Out is a major part of your life, and we'll talk about that in a minute. I just want to go back to the younger Marchbank when you were a child. Tell me a little bit about your background and if there were any creative influences within your family.
Both my parents' life was extremely altered by the war. My father was seriously wounded in the war, lost a leg, and he always wanted to be an architect, but the war got in the way. Ended up working in this family business, which has nothing to do with architecture. My mother was younger, and she was went straight from school into the army. She was the youngest ever lieutenant colonel in the British Army. And so if she wanted to do anything else, that was rather taken over by her being in the army, and she stayed in the army until about 1947 and working in Berlin. And but she's a very good painter. She's a very good watercolourist, and I have some of her paintings, which I was looking at recently, and they're very like the sort of photographs I take for myself when I'm not doing something on a brief. But I think the sort of mixture of my mother and my father ended up with me being sort of half architect, half painter, and I did, as I said earlier, you know, always have this idea of being commercial artists. I didn't know really what it meant, but it was art with a message somehow.
Yes.
And I used to, as 8, 9, 10 years old, produce magazines. And I used to produce them in duplicate or triplicate, exactly copying the writing out each page exactly the same. If I made a mistake, I would make the same mistake deliberately in the other copies so that it looked like it was printed.
So even then you were editorially minded. You liked the idea of magazines.
Yeah. I think print is...
So what were you looking at that time? This would have been in...
Well, I think... The Eagle.
The Eagle, of course.
Absolutely adore the Eagle.
Every designer's favourite of a certain era.
Now it would be Dawn and Kindersley, but in the 50s it would be sort of illustrated history books, which I used to absolutely fascinate me. And then in the early 60s the colour supplement started, yes, which I thought was a message from God.
Yeah.
You know, the early work of Michael Rand and everything, and I used to collect them.
Yes.
My mother threw them all away, and I'll never forgive her. but that really did influence me enormously, the Sunday Times colour supplement and the Observer, yes, in 63, 64.
Yeah, I mean, it was an extraordinary period, and it's sort of, I think that whole era that came out of the 60s following what was probably, I always think of the, because I think we're contemporaries, I always think of the 50s as a very kind of gloomy grey period, you know. As a child, my grandmother lived in Canada, and she used to have Canadian newspapers sent over, and they had colour supplements in the 1950s. Mm. With comic strip pullouts, and I would collect those. So
I used to see the Saturday Evening Post occasionally, yeah, which was like that.
Absolutely.
And it was like
Dick Tracy
book.
And all of those.
Colour gravure.
That's right.
How the colour subs are printed here.
Beautiful. So what about brothers, sisters? Do you have any?
I have one brother who's was a Merchant Navy captain. He's now the Harbour Master of Brisbane, who's 4 years older than me, and I have a younger brother, Matthew, who is a very highly talented joiner who made all the dealers' benches in Lloyd's and
all the
benches you sit on in the Tate Modern, amongst many other projects.
The rather beautiful...
The rubber in.
Lovely, yes.
But he's a master craftsman.
So there's creativity running through your family, that's for sure. Okay, well, let's now go... move on to Time Out, because Time Out is a very significant period of your life, because you were there from 1970 until 1983.
I carried on doing the covers, but I left full time working there, and I was there about 4 years, I suppose.
But
then I carried on doing the covers.
You carried on doing the covers
only for a long time.
Yeah. So you joined them at a time when I think the magazine was a small format magazine.
It was a folded up poster. Then it was a paperback sized little black and white only stapled together thing. And it was on a fortnightly frequency, and everyone on the magazine wanted it to go weekly, because the advertising was impossible to get for fortnightly. Mm. Because of the print deadlines and everything, meant that an ad might be 3 weeks old by the time it got out. If you were advertising a concert or something, it would be 3 weeks from the time that they put the ad in.
Yeah.
You couldn't produce you couldn't produce as paperbacks, sort of A5 sized magazine on the machines they had available. Mm. It had to go to roughly A4 size. Tony Elliott, the publisher, really thought this was impossible to do, because he had once seen someone pulling a Time Out out of their coat pocket and looking at it under a street lamp. But anyway, we managed to persuade him to go to sort of A4 size, which meant we could go weekly. And I tell you, the difference between running a weekly magazine and running a fortnightly is absolutely enormous, because you have to start the new one halfway through doing the old one every week, and so the editorial meeting that is going on while your head is full of what you're actually doing in the last issue. And also the problems with doing, we were about 96, 100 something pages every week, and doing that amount of pasted up paper artwork in-house is absolutely terrible.
The thing I would ask you about that magazine particularly is that I can sort of see parallels in the kind of structuring of Twen, in Twen magazine itself. I seem to remember many narrow columns with filled with text and punctuated by imagery and graphics, but which is, you know,
terrifically actually more refreshing. Of an influence was New York Magazine, which was designed by Pushpin and Milton Glaser.
Yes, yes.
Hand in that.
Yeah.
And also sort of Edwardian encyclopedias, which have very narrow columns and lots of little pictures and inter-column rules and that sort of thing. Writers would say to me, why didn't you have wider columns and everything? And I'd say, well, you know, you'd have so much white space sort of after lines of addresses and all this kind of stuff that if you added up all that white space, it would be equivalent to sort of 10 blank pages in the issue.
Yeah.
And also pictures.
It's a very interesting thing because, you know, the classic argument that designers often have with clients is that they want more white space and clients often want to fill the space. But the interesting thing about, I think, what you did at Time Out is that I think the functional side of the magazine, the structural side, became, a major issue for you in so far as that you...
You mean the production of it?
The production and the structuring, the actual...
I'll try and make this work. There were four basic areas I had to deal with. Firstly, before I did anything on the magazine, I went around and interviewed all the section editors and tried to find out what they were really trying to get over and what was the best format for their sections. For example, theatre was just a list of all the London theatres. I discovered that they really wanted to break it into West End and fringe theatre, and I think we at Time Out invented the word fringe theatre because we had to call this some, it came from the Edinburgh Festival fringe, obviously.
Yeah, yeah.
But we had to divide cinema into local, West End, BFI,
repertory,
whatever. Yeah. Music was jazz and so on. So everything was subdivided. This had not really been done in a logical way before. Then you had to guide people around the magazine, and all the writers really assumed that everyone knew what they were doing. And, of course, you had to put yourself in the shoes of a reader who's picked it up for the first time. So there had to be a visible structure to it, how to use this magazine index page and what have you. You actually had to say on the front cover of the magazine what it was.
Yeah.
You know, we came up with the line, the living guide to London or something like that. All this gets... I realised at one point I was the only person who was really looking over the whole magazine. There were lots of section editors. Tony, the publisher, was dealing with the business side more and printing and expanding the business. But no one was really looking at the whole...
So the editor himself at the time, whoever the editor was, and there were many, I know, over the years.
Well,
did they not? Were they not the?
There's two interpretations of the word editor. One is someone who steers a magazine, and I think the other is people who commission writers. And a lot of editors I work with really are commissioning editors.
Yeah.
Rather than saying, wouldn't it be great if we, went to full colour 6 centimetres square or something?
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Yeah.
So they're not pushing it as editors are in newspapers. Say, for example, with the Guardian deciding to go to the Berliner format and what have you. That they just think, oh, I've got to fill so many pigeonholes this week with copy. However exciting the ideas may be for that.
Yes. So really, your role as art director or art editor, whatever title you want to give it, was really orchestrating the visual manifestation.
Well, it's not just that.
Not just that, but also actually, having a big influence on how those journalists were working.
Well, I like the term information architect. It's a much more descriptive term for what I was doing. I was really working like an architect, making a permanent building that the information of Time Out could live in. And then secondarily, I was then making it possible for different features to say different things, the covers to speak to you on a weekly basis about different...
Well, let's go on to the covers, because, I think in terms of the memory of Time Out for me, it was, you know, the series of covers that you produce, and you know, there is a connection with George Lois and the Squire, without doubt, and I think you acknowledge that.
Great influence, yeah.
Even down to the use of Franklin, which is, you know, the one of your favourite certainly typefaces at that time.
Well, let's talk about Franklin. Let's talk about the typeface. Franklin Gothic to me is the one typeface that you can use for anything because it has no inherent built-in personality. Times is slightly bookish. Helvetica has a slightly sort of Swiss clinical quality to it. I wanted a typeface which could be used in any situation, and I think Franklin Gothic is probably it because it's much more human than Helvetica, which I love and I use for lots of things.
But I agree, yes. Helvetica has a clinical aspect, but I would sort of disagree. I think that Franklin has a real personality, and I think it's because of the G's, the lowercase G's, which are really very
and
unique.
And the figure one is much better.
And the figure one is wonderful.
Which is, in the magazine, you have to really look at the figure one, because you've always got a date.
They're terrific. But looking at these covers, and there are many, which you continue to do long after you left permanently, and I want to talk in a moment about another event that happened, which I'm sure you have some a take on. But the covers, actually, to me, looking at them, were constructed so much like the best advertising. In other words, you work in conjunction either with a writer or maybe you wrote a lot of the stuff yourself, but it's the combination of great writing and a great image that are working in harmony, but they're not replicating, so that you're getting something really very, very unique. And they become mini posters.
That was the idea. They really are
striking.
I wanted to use all the other magazines on newsstands as a backdrop to Time Out.
Yeah.
So I tended to go for white covers, which people were frightened of using them because the marketing people said they got dirty.
Yes.
If possible, no picture at all. If possible, no type at all. So they would stand out like a sore thumb or an extremely aggressive image. And the minimum amount of copy, I mean, the complete opposite to what I did on Time Out is say, Cosmopolitan, which has a sort of
everything. A menu.
Kneecap to top of head shot of a girl with a sort of enormous menu of what's inside.
So that's right.
I would try and go for a very short sentence on the front and make the colours as primary and as aggressive as possible.
And not only short sentences, but a short time scale, because these things were done in record
24
time.
Hours, yeah.
And, you know, the quality of photography was always terrific. The attention to detail was always... there's one in particular which I'll mention, which listeners might have seen, which is called Their Art Belongs to Dada. On this cover, which is a white cover, with that headline in the centre of the cover itself, the cover appears to be burning, revealing the contents page.
And which was designed 3 days after I did the cover.
Exactly. Well, when you read those contents, that contents page, which you can see through the burning paper, it's exactly the same.
Yeah, well, I got them to lay out the bottom 3 inches of page one, the text, so I can reproduce it exactly on the front cover.
And this is all in 24 hours, which is...
Yeah, but I mean, probably sometimes if I got information earlier, I could get maybe a maximum of 3 days on it. But that was a real, I mean, flying by the seat of my pants production-wise thing. There are flames against what appears to be a white background, so the background had to be slightly grey, and we had to do... photographing flames is just
very difficult.
And we didn't have all these were done without Photoshop.
Yes, and all of this, you know, this is in the days when repro would be any retouching was done by hand with brushes and acid.
We couldn't have retouching. It's too expensive.
So I mean, these covers stand up brilliantly still. I'm looking at them now. They just, you know, this for me was a golden period of British editorial design, and I think at around about the same period, there were people like David Driver who
Red
Radio Times and the Radio Times, there was a real connection. I think they used Franklin as well. Yeah. They used similar illustrators like Peter Brooks, who you used a lot, and Mick Brownfield, who you used a lot. And it was a period where it was very intelligent use of illustrations. They were not just
design and writing working together.
Absolutely.
The words, for me, always had to work with the image. I couldn't have them write a headline and then put an image to it, and the other way around. I mean, once I did a picture of it. It was an article about a policeman who planted a small shotgun in the back of someone's car so that he could be arrested. And I had a picture, I set up this wonderful picture with an actor and a sawn-off shotgun in the boot of a car holding up this sawn-off shotgun, and the headline was, "It's a fair cop?" And the editors changed it to, "Like a rabbit out of a bag," which completely changed the whole image because he didn't know it was a policeman. He didn't say, "It's a fair cop." I remember Peter Brooks had exactly the same thing on the cover of the Radio Times. He had a picture of two hands wringing the world like it was a dishcloth with one little drop of black oil coming out the bottom. And the headline was, "Oil Crisis," right? But they changed the headline to, "The World Wrung Dry."
So they're actually describing the picture, which is the thing you don't do.
Exactly. It's like a caption under a picture that says two men standing in front of a bus stop. You know.
I mean, that's a point. In fact, we should just mention, of course, that Peter Brooks is also a royal designer and also the political cartoonist of the time. So he moved on to great things. But at that time, he worked a lot with you, producing fantastic illustrations and with Driver over at Radio Times. And that was, for me, an exciting period because those two magazines, the magazine you work for and that magazine, seemed to be doing work far beyond anyone else at that time. And I think that this is the period where even the Sunday Times magazine was not as great as it certainly was back in the 60s, with, you know, when people like Dave King were involved in editorial design, and you know, you got a real sense that an intelligent designer was working with the editorial department to produce something that actually really was well thought through. Just talking for a moment about typography, and your view of typography, which is, you know, has a directness about imparting information in a clear, concise way, and this whole notion of typography as a decorative element. So I'm thinking, for example, of the world of the David Carsons of this world, where it would seem to me that that is not about reading type at all. And it sort of takes me back to sort of where we came in with your early underground magazines. All of the underground magazines that I remember, you know, prior to you working on them, they were designed specifically so that you couldn't read anything.
Well, I've done that as well. No, but overlaying pictures on type does not make for readability.
Printing type in yellow.
You never got proofs.
Yeah.
So you didn't really know what was happening. And this is probably a very good education for me, but made it very unpleasant for some of the writers whose articles were made totally unreadable. We were working totally without proofs, and it was a really good grounding for me because I knew how to predict what was going to happen without having proofs after a few mistakes. But the underground press was not, an average issue of Alter magazine really wouldn't pay much heed to what the content of the article was for its illustration, the way it was presented visually, and the typeface they used for the headline or whatever. What I tend to do is, I don't use many typefaces. I tend to use probably four. one thing started off on, which I didn't really finish, was the different, like when you're talking about timeout, and I did the sort of information architecture and I sorted out the magazine, then there's the actual typographic design of the whole thing, and then there's the sort of communicating of individual ideas through the cover.
Yeah.
And it's sort of three things that I regard as separate activities. It's like organising information, yeah, which doesn't actually end up with any visible design
it's a structural thing.
Yeah, and then designing the superstructure, if you like, and, yeah, and the typography, which is very complicated.
Yeah.
You lay down a... I've just done a magazine in New York, and they've started running it from my first roughs. Thank you very much, you know. What? Well, when I haven't sent you the grids. Oh, well, we've done it all. You know, they sent me a PDF today of what they've done for me.
You have to.
Amazing.
Continuing on Time Out, tell me a little bit more about the specific areas that you feel that you contributed to that magazine. Over and about, you know, we've talked about the covers at length and how they came about, and they were sort of mini posters in their own right. But going back to the magazine itself, in terms of how it was structured, and all of those difficult elements.
When I arrived at Time Out, it wasn't structured. Individual sections, theatre, film, music, whatever, were organised in a completely different way. So when you, as a reader, went through the magazine, you had to obey different rules for each section. I interviewed all the editors of each section and basically sort of structured it all the same way throughout. So I made the information architecture, if you like, for the whole thing. Having done that and sort of schooled them up into always writing addresses in the same way and telephone numbers in the same way and times,
yeah,
and actually agreed what the actual coverage of the magazine was, because some sections wandered from the cover dates.
So you're kind of creating a house style.
Well, more than a house style, editing it.
Rather like Penguin, you know, Tischold and Schmuller created a house style for Penguin. You were creating a house style for Time Out.
Well, yeah, I mean, the information structure.
Exactly.
Yeah, and then once having done that, there was nothing to see having done that, except some bits of typed paper saying what was going to happen. I then did a dummy, which turned into the first issue of the weekly Time Out. And that was, so I had to, within the very limiting structure of Hot Metal Repro, done at a very cheap typesetter in Finsbury Park, who didn't possess a set square, which caused lots of problems pasting up his columns of type, which were in a sort of gentle arc, like a bow. So we established the whole typographical setup. So then I was doing every single page myself, but after a while I could hand it on to other people, because all the problems had been confronted and sorted out, hopefully. Then I could spend more time on the visuals. We had to rely, because of no budget, on found visuals or press pictures supplied. What so often happened was that you'd put a picture of a rock star in the listing, and that would be the picture on the full page ad facing the listing. So I learnt after a short time not to take free publicity pictures. And often would illustrate very minor acts in sections and sort of unknown films and that kind of thing, which was greatly liked by the section editors because they could push.
So were you
unknowns.
You were able to push your own interests in the magazine,
yeah,
particularly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
As I said, you know, I was. Each section had an individual editor, but I had a overview of the whole thing, and I could push for things I found visually appealing, which could you know, direct people to things that otherwise in the listings that they wouldn't naturally have seen. The other thing I did on Time Out, before I got there, Time Out was just a listing, entertainment listing magazine. On Friends magazine, we'd started quite a serious news section. When I got to Time Out, I suggested they, as it was a London magazine, that they did a news section. And I brought in a lot of journalists who worked for Friends.
Mm-hmm.
And we started an extremely left-wing biased news section, which is the root of the troubles that ended up with the strike in the late 80s.
Which I want to talk about in a moment, yeah.
But the news, I'm the culprit when it comes to the news section. But Time Out did in the 70s was really an extremely aggressively left-wing newspaper, which I think is great that you should have such a powerful left-wing voice with listings of where to go and see the latest Walt Disney movie or whatever.
Well, that left-wing bias takes me to the very fact that they had this overarching structure at Time Out where everyone received the same equal
that
pay.
I was no longer involved then apart from doing the covers, and I really was. The covers were a completely separate thing to the magazine.
Sure.
I only talked to the editors. But I knew this was going on, obviously. The union setup was getting ridiculous. But on the other hand, the management style was also being ridiculous. It ended up with a sit-in by the staff at Time Out. The management played martial music at full volume through the tannoy system so they couldn't sleep. I mean, you know, this had...
Sounds like China.
And I was on holiday at this time. Tony Elliott, the owner of the magazine, rang me and said, apparently, you own the logo and we want it taken off their strike sheet. You know, the newspaper they were handing out saying, not Time Out. They wanted the logo taken off, and the lawyers had told them that I owned the copyright, and I had to. So I said, "Well, will you sell? I'll sell you the logo for the grand sum of £2,000." I think it's now been valued at something like £5 million. But so I wrote Tony a little handwritten letter saying I was giving him the copyright of the logo. In retrospect, I think that was rather a stupid move. But anyway, he stopped the strike newspaper. After a while, it ended up with the magazine breaking up and all the news department people going off to start City Limits.
They went off exactly to start another magazine, which was supported by the GLC, called City Limits. And I think either the covers or maybe part of the interior was designed by David King.
It was,
And meanwhile, you, I think, went off around about that time anyway to start another magazine called Event.
Well, Richard Branson was always wanting to do a Time Out type magazine. I was doing the covers of Time Out when the strike started, and therefore I was not doing them anymore, and Time Out was not on the streets for quite a few weeks. Branson rang me up, said, would you like £1 million to start an alternative Time Out? And being out of work, and it was rather difficult to say no. So. We did, in fact, make a pretty good stab at setting up, doing all the information architecture, if you like, setting up a very credible magazine, starting from scratch much later than Time Out had started. We managed to have full colour or many pages inside the magazine, which Time Out didn't have. Our print schedule was much tighter. We had a helicopter flying artwork, this is before the days of email, to the printers, things like that. And it was much cheaper. And a lot of these things were taken by Time Out when it eventually came back to be republished. Unfortunately, Richard Branson does not understand publishing. He thought it was a record, an LP, and therefore it could go to number one, which it did when it first came out, but he didn't understand that you had to keep on doing it every week and you have to keep advertisers happy and readers happy. And the sales went down because it was deteriorating in size and the advertisers therefore backed out, so it became smaller and smaller. They took colour out, he saved money here and there, and it just sort of faded away, it dwindled, against all the advice of the publishing industry. I think if Event had continued and been run in the way that by a publisher rather than a record executive, who he was at that time, It may have succeeded, but...
But it sadly failed.
It faded away.
Along with City Limits and of course...
City Limits faded because of lack of business expertise and cash.
Yes.
Event faded because it was visually reduced in front of people and therefore they thought it was a loser when it needn't have been. We had a fantastic staff when we started Event. A lot of people from Time Out. From day one it could have been great, but it was just Richard didn't understand how to run magazines.
But out of all that, like a phoenix, Time Out rose above everything and is still with us today.
Yeah.
All those years later, and there's no other magazine still, really, that to touch it in terms of its weekly coverage.
In most capital cities in the world.
Yes. Let's move on now to another important period of your life, which is your connection with Music Sales and Omnibus Press, where you were able to use much of the kind of recognisable approach and style that you created within Time Out in a completely different era, which is music, sheet music publishing, which is... goes way back to the 1920s when a modern day equivalent.
Bob Wise was the son, one of the three sons of the man who started publishing music by Pete Seeger and people in America. He set up a company called Music Sales and then started getting other people's copyrights, so they're publishing sheet music. Sheet music used to be, in the 20s and 30s, something that people would buy and play at home. But when records started coming, of course, sheet music just became something that you got when you got your Chinese copy of a Fender Stratocaster and played Apache. But no one had... Bob Wise came to England from America with the idea that you could produce... instead of little bits of flimsy sheet music, beautiful, huge, colourful, well-designed books of the very well arranged and engraved music by Bob Dylan, Elvis, whatever, the Beatles. And it really completely changed the whole music market. People who couldn't read music bought these books because they were
so attractive. I mean, they were. Yeah.
And he started. John McCollum was his first designer, and
that's
people
right.
like Philip Castle did covers and
I
things.
I remember.
And I took over from John McCollum about 1972, I think, three probably. And the whole market absolutely exploded. I was doing. One year, I remember. I worked out that we'd done more, actually published more books than Penguin, because the runs were very small on these expensive music books. We'd actually done more covers than Penguin in 1 year. Mm. We'd done about three or four covers a day in designing the insides, because all the music pages were done to a formula.
Yeah.
But they were very interesting to do because previous to doing Event, I was art director of Virgin Records, and I found that extremely constricting because in the contract was that the artist had the final say on the album covers, you know. And I don't like that typeface. I don't like purple, you know, etc. So, but doing all this stuff for Music Sales, I was the boss, and I didn't have to ask Paul McCartney if he liked this particular photograph.
No.
He would tell me later, or I'd get a rude letter or something. But there was no constraints on it, so we were completely free to do, probably much freer than an ordinary straight hardback publishing company would be for the covers.
You did experiment enormously, and. And also, you're looking at those covers now, going back, I suppose the directness of your work, the boldness of your work, actually was slightly tempered depending on the artist whose music you were you were representing. You were able to find a far broader palette of emotions with these covers, and it's a very rich theme of your work. Nevertheless, having said that, it always has that kind of very logical Piers Marchbank approach.
Yeah, well, I mean, I'm transmitting the message, you know. And a lot of all these music book covers, as with the Time Out covers, were done on very low budgets.
Yeah.
And I had a whole armory of way of using found images,
yeah,
rescreening,
yeah,
small pictures, you know, putting a mezzotint over a half-tone screen when,
yeah,
I'd blown it up so much it,
yeah,
looked like a checkerboard, you know, all that,
yeah,
kind of. And working directly with colour originators, the people who actually made the film the plates were made from.
Mm.
I used to go down and twiddle all them.
And experiment with
those.
Yeah.
So this is all... This is all on photographs.
Yeah, I remember the four-colour mezzotints, which were always kind of gritty and... You know,
well, they were very hard to half-tone screen.
Well, of course, but they actually took on a very documentary, yeah, kind of hard-hitting character, which is very strong.
Well, I mean, I had a black and white print made into a mezzotint, and I thought, well, if you separate all the colours from a colour, so you've got the magenta, the yellow, the cyan, etc., of a colour set, and you rotate the halftone, the mezzotint screen, so they're not using exactly the same position of grains, you can make a four-colour mezzotint.
Mm.
The guy said, oh, it won't work. But so I said, just try it, can you? And it did. And it's a very good trick, but you can't do it on computers.
No, well, there's always a downside to computers. So we talked about Virgin Records. You also, for a while, worked with Virgin Books as well, which is another little moment in your life. And you went on to design aspects of The Guardian, The Weekend Guardian.
Well,
independent magazine.
This is a long time ago, and they've lost in the midst of time on working on that. But it was when they were... The Guardian was... Alan Ruskridge was still assistant editor, and on The Guardian they were trying to do what effectively is a Berliner-sized supplement, which is... They ended up with a whole newspaper that size.
And then, of course, you continued for a while with Marxism Today.
No, I did
the covers.
Well, I did Marxism Today for about 2 or 3 years.
Yeah.
Right up to when Marxism sort of
folded. 92 with the cover, which somebody said the end.
Yeah, well, that was my idea. They were folding it because Marxism really had ceased to be a viable proposition to base an entire weekly or monthly magazine on. So they're going to close, and there was a lot of argument about what they should do on the front. So I said, look, this is the end of Marxism Today. Put the end on fucking big.
Yeah.
You know? So this is what we did, and it was very successful. It got on the picture of the cover got on the front of the Sunday Times and the Observer, I think.
Mm. It's a great cover. And then it sort of ended your sort of period of editorial design as we know it, because it was such a long period. And you started Studio 20, which is...
Well, Studio 20 is just a name for my studio, you know, because it's embarrassing answering the phone saying Piers Marchbank Studios. But editorial design sort of... I didn't fade away from it. It rather faded away from me. I mean, editorial design is so much different now.
Yeah,
I wanted
to ask you. I mean, you know, without, you know, having any sort of sour grapes or anything like that, it would seem to me, and I'd like your view on it, that, you know, looking at Time Out now, it's a kind of a magazine that just lacks that creative input
it's consumer orientated. Time Out now would never ever think of putting London canals on the front page,
yeah,
or, you know, schizophrenia, or it would have a star interview, mm, or it would be based on a consumer area, like eating outside in gastro pubs, mm, or something. It's just a listings magazine. It doesn't have the political content it used to, because the news department has entirely left, and it is consumer orientated.
And the same can be said for the other magazine we mentioned earlier, which is the Radio Times. The Radio Times, same thing has happened. It no longer has, you know, with both Time Out and Radio Times, you would have a point of difference. You would look at that magazine and there would always be something interesting over and above the listing.
What David Driver used to do in the late 60s, early 70s, Radio Times was, for example, if there was some coronation or royal wedding or something, he would have behind the scenes spread of the route and how they were going to where all the cameras were and how did they do this.
The diagrams, you know, particularly.
Now it would be an interview with you know, Prince Charles, or not a straight text piece by David Dimbleby or whatever. And there's no thinking behind it. How can we really make this exciting? I believe that you can make any subject exciting. And that was the sort of theory I had behind the Time Out covers. They would say, oh great, we've got an interview with Mick Jagger this week. And I say, well, he's got a film coming out tomorrow, you know, whatever. Every other paper's going to have him. Let's do, you know, dirty London canals or whatever. So we make it really different.
And you would stand out because everyone else was doing those covers.
I mean, this, in front of me, you've got open this...
The heroin.
Heroin
cover, your Time Out.
There was an article about how the Iranian Revolution had forced all the drug dealers from Iran to come to England. And the street price of heroin had gone down from 120 to about 65. So I distilled this into the cover, just saying heroin, 120, crossed out 60, I cheated a bit, and put in trompe l'oeil on the front a little folded bit of paper with some brown sugar in it. And this brought the attention to the BBC, and the day it came out, it was on the 1 o'clock news. Yeah. Heroin reduced by half on the streets of London because of the Iranian Revolution. Their original idea for the cover of this was, I think, a thing about fashion shops or something on that sort of level.
Well, we're coming right up to the present time. I mean, over in recent years, you've created identities, and for example, the Bank Restaurant here in London, and also Wine Labours for John Armit, and probably noteworthy is all of the packaging range that you've done for the John Lewis Partnership, which incidentally, interestingly, the original logo for John Lewis was actually designed by another royal designer that you may or may not know, which is Robin Day. He created the original John Lewis logo.
Did he?
Yeah.
Well, the replacement is designed by John McConnell, another
RDI. Yes, well, there you go.
Who is my boss on John Lewis.
And in fact, you come against, you come up, not up against, but you actually collaborate with other royal designers. I think Martin Hunt.
Yeah.
And probably Robin Levine as well. Yeah. So you're responsible for all of the packaging for kitchenware and ceramics and chinaware and so forth.
Glass and cutlery.
Yeah. Which is
anything to do with eating, apparently.
Yes. Which is, again, interestingly, looking at that packaging, which I have done, has the same simplicity and directness your work.
I apply basically the same. I mean, there's not a lot of difference between the cover of a magazine and the front of a box in a store. It's a poster telling you what it's all about and trying to grab your attention with various devious means. With John Lewis, John McConnell is a wonderful designer and has done a fantastic job on John Lewis. His ultra simple approach, you know, real modern movement. Is it really necessary? If not, throw it out. Less is more, etc. It's very similar to my approach, and I do look at some of the packs I've done for John Lewis and think they look very much like Time Out covers, you know, with different markets.
Well, you've come now to a conclusion. You've been working in this industry now for, you know, almost 40 years, which is you know.
Horrifying.
Well, it goes so quickly, I have to say. So with all of that knowledge under your belt, do you have any words of wisdom for any young hopefuls that might be listening to this podcast?
I think ignore fashion and style. Go for transmitting a simple message, and remove everything that is not ultimately necessary to doing that. So you end up, if you my ultimate design object is the Japanese flag. That is the perfect piece of graphic design. A red blob on a white, no type, nothing. I mean, it is the most beautiful object in the world, but I think that if you can get near that, that's good. If you look at a lot of my Time Out covers, they are tend to end up looking like Japanese flags in one way or another. Very okay. Simple, big image.
On that note, Piers Marchbank, thank you very much.
Thank you.
This is an RSA podcast.